Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is episode 71 of the Distraction Pieces podcast. My name is Scroobius Pip. Some people know me as at Scroobius Pipio, but that's only in the digital realm. Thank you for tuning in. Big love that we've already received this week because of the Richard Herring podcast on Wednesday, and this being your extra Friday special because it's December and I like Christmas and I want everyone to be happy and cheery and I want to give you treats of extra. Oh man, I've just remembered. I've just had a thing. This guy, I think he's Scottish, which freaked me out more. This guy on Twitter hit me up. This is unrelated to everything. This guy on Twitter hit me up and he'd recorded a Vine of him doing an impression of me saying, welcome, welcome, welcome. And it's freaked me out. I've watched it at least 100 times, I think, and it's really uncomfortable because he doesn't look anything like me. I mean, he's not ugly, you know. I mean, obviously I'm pretty much a male model. I just chose a different path, but yeah, he's not hairy, so there's that. But yeah, it's really weird. I don't know why I'm talking about that. I can't even remember his name, but it freaked me out, so stop freaking me out, guy. Speech Development Records is my label. A lot of you will have seen our wonderful Black Friday offers that we had, which basically at speechdevelopmentrecords.com, I do this every year now, on Black Friday, we close because we don't want your money on that weird commercial holiday. I know all holidays are commercial now, but that's like unabashedly commercial holiday. So yeah, that's the one day of the year that we're closed, and we encourage you to instead spend your money on maybe a nice pizza or some cookies or going for a walk, like buying some healthy duck feed and going and feeding some ducks or squirrels, just doing something that doesn't involve sitting on your computer or going absolutely mental in a shop. Trying to get these crazy deals, which normally aren't really deals. These are businesses, you dummies. It means that the price they've been charging you the rest of the year is a fucking rip-off. And that's what we don't do. That's at speechdevelopmentrecords.com. You can head there now and buy all your Christmas goodness. We try and just make stuff as affordable as possible all year round. And that sounds like a big plug and advert now. But yeah, that's kind of what it is. That's why on Black Friday we closed. It's the one day of a year that you can't give us your money. So hope you all enjoyed that. But you can head there now, and there's still plenty of time, obviously, to get stuff in for Christmas. We've got my book. My DVD would be a great Christmas present. It's a two-DVD set. So I'm just saying. There's a brand new bobble hat. In fact, I won't go into too much because we've got the Team 3W advert to come as well anyway. But yeah, speechdevelopmentrecords.com. Check it out. A few people have been annoyed that I've been putting pictures of the Team 3W merch on social media, but they don't realise that it's still not just in the normal web store. You still need to listen. At no point have I posted the Team 3W address on social media. So I post the picture to tease people a bit, and then they go to the web store and it's not there. And it's like, yeah, it's because you can't have it because you're just pretending to be a fan and a listener when you're not. Anyway, this week's guest is John Osborne, who's fantastic. I've known John for a while now. I met him, I mean, we talk about a lot of this in the podcast, so it's not worth me going into too much detail, but I met him through a group of poets, including Tim Clare, and Ross Sutherland, and Chris Hicks, and Luke Wright, and Joe Dunthorne, and some great people. But he's just doing amazing at the moment, and is a massive inspiration, I think. So yeah, I won't go into too much detail because he goes into the detail in the podcast. So I will allow that and I will cut this intro short. I've been doing some long intros recently, which makes people mad sometimes, which I love. If you're mad, I'm at Scroobius Pip on Twitter and Instagram and facebook.com/Scroobius Pip. Hit me up with your anger. It's hilarious to me. This is John Osborne. Enjoy. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces.
squeeze of fiction is the intro to the station. I'm not going to hear it on my headphones, but I'm sure we'll be fine. Can you hear it on your headphones?
Yeah.
Oh, you lucky duck. All right, well, there you go.
Oh, no, I can hear them. I can hear music on my headphones.
Right, no, yeah, take them off. That's nothing to do with us. That has been the start of the podcast, me wondering about headphones.
I call them cans.
Cans. Oh, look at you, all professional. Yeah. You're a radio expert. I'm joined by John Osborne. How are you, sir?
I have turned up to meet you late and soaking wet because of rain.
Yeah, upon my request. I said I will not accept you on time or dry.
So. Yeah, I was going to come like 2 minutes early and nice and dry, but you weren't into that.
I'm very
that
demanding.
All.
I've got very specific. I like to feel I'm in a position of power. Yeah. So I, you will know, I'm dry.
Yeah.
And I got here last night and slept over in the studio yeah. just so I was nice and early and dry. So
am I wet enough for you?
Yeah, just about. I've got some water, so if you dry up, I mean, we can go on for a while sometimes with these things. So if you dry up, then we'll sort that out. But how are you, man?
I'm really good. I've just got here on the train and I put... I don't often do this and I don't know why, but I just put all of my songs on my phone onto shuffle
yep.
and put it full blast. And for yes. 2 hours, I've just had like a really lovely journey. And because I listen to lots of podcasts and because I do lots of writing, I don't often allow myself to just listen to like my favourite songs. Oh, so I feel very...
How much skipping did you do, if any?
I do
of
do
songs,
some. I would
not,
say
not, a lot, not up and down the track, enjoying them.
Yeah,
music.
I do a bit of both. I would say I'm a 10% skipper.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
It depends. It depends on how busy the train is, and if you've got easy access to your phone.
Yeah, otherwise you have to just.
You don't want to elbow someone just to skip through.
And
a
do you? I'm going to go into this deeply here. Do you just shuffle your songs in general, or have you got a playlist of here's my shuffle playlist, essentially?
Every time I do all of my songs, and every time I do it, I think I need to sort myself out a shuffle playlist.
Yeah, because it's tough, man. I've had that before. I was doing a James Acaster's show where he puts your phone on shuffle, and it's great. I love him. He's hilarious. And then I'm not sure if I meant to say, but he's filmed a pilot to try and make it a TV series. And for that, because I'd been doing some acting, and because I've got no friends, I'm incredibly unsociable, the way I learn my lines is I record myself doing the other lines, and I act with myself. So I'll have two versions on my phone, one with all the lines, and one missing out the lines I meant to learn. So because my phone was full of stuff like that, I was like, I need to make a little playlist that's just the songs. Yeah. So it was still random and still all my songs, but I was like, I don't want embarrassing stuff to come up with also me going, are you doing?
I assume the producers of that show also
just me talking to myself. It wouldn't be that entertaining.
Did you see his show, James Acaster, his most recent Edinburgh show?
I didn't, no.
He's so funny.
He's great. I've mainly seen him on panel shows.
Yeah.
My mum caught him at Edinburgh and said it was amazing. And I've not caught his show yet. It's on at the moment though. I think he's touring again now. So
yeah, he's good.
Try and catch him.
He's one of the good ones.
So I don't know where to start really. Where should we begin? I don't want to jump straight into your amazing success at the moment because that'd feel trite. But
yeah, that'd be awful.
It's going well right now. You've got a TV series.
Yeah, that's the headlines.
Yeah,
that's why I do you know what? I'm not a person who often emails people sort of unprompted.
Yeah.
But I emailed you to say, can I come onto your podcast? Because I've got a sitcom that's on TV. Me and my friend Molly, well, I'll talk about it briefly and then we'll go into it in more detail.
Yeah.
But me and my friend Molly, 3 years ago, got drunk in a pub and decided to write a sitcom together. We'd never written a sitcom. We'd never written anything together. We had no real plans to do anything. We just thought, let's do it as a project to see what happens, to see what it would be like. And so after that drunken conversation, we talked about what the sitcom could be, and it's on telly at the moment. And we're really proud of it. We've had a really nice time. And so we thought we'd try and let as many people as possible know.
It's amazing. I've been loving it. It's called After Hours. It's got a Jamie Winston, the wonderful Georgina Campbell.
I'm
a big
brilliant.
Fan. She's amazing.
She did
the murdered Obama boyfriend and won loads of stuff last year for that. And I refuse to call him anything other than Father Dougal. But in general, there's a really great, a strong cast. And I mean, we will touch into it briefly and then come back, because I want to, let's talk about it a little, what it is at the start. And then later on, I want to get into the process of writing it and the process of of getting it made. But yeah, it's about a pirate radio station, essentially, that takes place on a canal boat.
Which yeah,
anyone who listened to our live podcast, we had a fan on called Keith who lives on a canal boat, and my excitement at canal boats was quite huge.
Beautiful
and
things.
People have found it laughable, but laughing at me. But I do find it fascinating, so I was all the more excited when I watched the first episode and saw. Yeah,
I like those things in life that you mock and then think about it and then realise that they are absolutely right.
That's
people who live on a boat, yeah, you think, why do they live on a boat? And go, oh, because it's a beautiful,
really
idyllic
wonderful
way to live.
Yeah. A way to live, and doesn't have so many of the ties of our current, every current form of living, whether it be extortionate renting or extortionate mortgages and deposits,
yeah,
and leases and things like that. It's like, right, that's
live
far
on a
more...
boat.
Just live on a boat,
get
man.
On a boat.
But yeah, so it's about a part of... A radio station, essentially, in a small town in bloody Shanklin.
Is it Shankly? It's like a
or is it Shankly?
Shankly, yeah. It's a fictional town.
That's where I heard it wrong. I heard it as Shanklin.
Yeah. It does sound too similar.
I mean,
to
we'll get into this, yeah, but obviously, I've had you at Bestival numerous times,
yeah,
and I always stay at Shanklin in Bestival.
Oh,
so I was
you?
Like,
yeah,
has that had some inverted influence? But clearly not. So I'm
well. We can
on
pretend
that,
it's Shanklin.
Yeah,
if you like.
Let's pretend for this podcast it's all based in Shanklin, and that was the main influence and tipping point.
Yeah, but do you know what? So that was one of two times in my life I remember sort of emailing someone unsolicited,
yeah,
with a quite cheeky request going,
yeah,
hi Scroobius Pip. I never know whether to, on my email, whether to how to start the email, yeah, hi Scroobius Pip, hi Pip,
yeah,
hi Mr. Pip,
I like
Senior
it. See,
Pip.
See, most people call me just Pip, but one of my favourite people, Brett Goldstein, who we had on the podcast as well, always, in person and in email or on the phone, will call me Scroobius Pip,
yeah,
in full. Each time I'm like, hi Scroobius. Oh, thank you Scroobius Pip. And
yeah,
I thoroughly enjoy that from him. So yeah.
But when I've heard people call you Pip, it always sounds quite cool. I don't think I can pull it off. So I just go, hi mate, I think I normally go, but what mate? So the other time that I remember emailing was back in the day, in 2009, this was the first time that I met you, was when you were doing Colin Murray's Radio 1 show,
yes,
a late night spoken word slot.
Yeah.
And I listened to Ross Sutherland do a poem on it. And I'm friends with Ross.
Yeah.
And Ross is my favourite poet.
He's amazing.
And I emailed you really cheekily and just said, oh, I really like what you do on Colin Murray's show. If you ever need more poets, can,
yeah,
I come on and have a go? And you emailed me back and just said, yeah, we're getting a load of people together in a couple of months. I'll add you to the list. And then I went in there and then I got another email saying, thank you for coming along. By the way, if you want to do Camp Bestival,
yeah,
come along. So as a result of Camp Bestival, I've done the last five Bestivals.
Yeah.
It's a lot of Bestivals, isn't it?
It's a lot
it?
Of Bestivals. I mean, I love it because it's one of the things, again, I think we talked about with when Josie Long was on, is the fact that so many of these things are really close-knit and really simple and easy to get involved in. It's,
yeah,
people actually putting in the effort to get involved because... The fact is, that's exactly how I got on a lot of spoken word nights, was I'd be at an open mic or at something and someone would be handing out a flyer and I'd say, oh, can I come and do something at that? And they,
yeah,
go, yeah. Because the fact is, they really need people to do stuff. You really want to do stuff. It's kind of,
yeah,
it benefits everyone, so yeah.
But I do think about that sometimes. I think if I hadn't emailed you after hearing Ross on Radio 1...
Yeah.
You wouldn't have booked me for Camp Best. Maybe this would have happened in the end. Maybe,
yeah,
our paths would have crossed in a different way. But I don't. Like, I think if I hadn't sent out that slightly cheeky email, I wouldn't have done Camp Bestival, and then I wouldn't have done the last five Bestivals. And
yeah,
I've had such good times at all of those things.
It's great. No, again, I think there is some logic there, and I always like to be nice and frank about things. At that point, it was when I was first booking like the festivals and that. And at that point, I was really like, right, it's a festival. It's kind of a tough crowd. People, someone like Ross or Joshua Edahen and people like that are really hard-hitting, grab them. And I'd seen your stuff before and felt you were amazing but quite quiet and soft with it. And I thought, would that work at a festival crowd? So I'd considered it, and then when you hit me up, it prompted it. And again, it was a wonderful revelation because from the first one,
yeah,
you'd gone down a treat and...
It's been
so
fun.
It fits so well at Bestival in particular, that everyone on an island.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're so cool, those people who come to watch the,
yeah,
those spoken word afternoons or,
yeah,
evenings now, aren't they? Do you know something funny that you said to me we got there last year. I think it was the first day, and it was just me and you got there first. And this, I think, just like a fan, a Pip fan, came up and said, "Oh my God, the spoken word lineup's so good this year! It's so exciting." He was really excited, and you said, "Yeah, we've got some of the finest spoken word artists in the whole of the country performing this weekend, plus John, who's very reliable." And I like those things that are half a joke and half true. Like, I will turn up. I won't cause any fuss, and I won't be too much.
You see, I worry I get over familiar with festivals and introduce a new one time. And again, we've met plenty of times, but mainly at work.
Yeah, mainly in fields.
Yeah, so mainly in fields. But I always remember introducing you a 1 year at Best of All and wondering if I'd been too familiar, because I think I went something along the lines of, this guy is so dedicated, he's made sure he really looks as if he's been living in a field for the last 3 days. Because, you know, you go, again, that's the beauty of the spoken word. Most of the people I book on the spoken word scene is that, I mean, the fee's all right, but more than anything, you get an amazing weekend,
it's
an amazing
great
festival.
Weekend. Yeah.
It's really enjoyable. And I've had people turn it down because the fees haven't been good enough, and I'm non-negotiable on my fees. Yeah. I have my slots, and it's like, when we started it, I know for a fact it was the best paying spoken word gig on the festival circuit. So although my budgets haven't grown and some might be better or some might be worse, it's still, I know they're good for the amount of time you're having to do and things like that. So I've had agents and that try and hardball me and go, all right, well, how about, and they think I'm hardballing when I'm saying, it'd be best if you play so. And it's not, I never take offence. If someone has got to a point where their fee has to be this much, then that's fine. I don't want to undercut or make them worth less to other promoters or anything like that. But yeah, they've constantly thought I'm hardballing when I'm like, no, let's leave it. They're like, all right, well, maybe if we do this, and then it's like, no, I've retracted the invitation.
But I've been going to festivals since I was 16, and so the fact that for the last 7 or 8 years I've been paid to go to them to perform.
It's crazy, isn't it?
It's so much fun. I love it.
My introduction to Glastonbury is the one that I've been to at least 10 times and I've never paid, because originally I couldn't afford to pay, so I'd go there and break in.
Yeah.
And then I had the genius idea of making a career.
Yeah,
so
good idea.
For free. And
how's that going for you?
it works a treat. It's such a good blag. But what was your kind of musical upbringing then? You've always been heavily into music. That comes across in a lot of your Edinburgh shows, your book, and the TV show, of course. So, so what was your musical upbringing, and where did you get your music from initially?
I was a Blur fan. I didn't care about music until I saw Blur.
Yeah.
Like, quite slightly later on than, probably I was about 15 or 16. So, like, as a young teenager, I just had absolutely no interest. My parents weren't music fans.
Oh, wow.
I've got a twin sister. I don't have older, most people get into it through their big brother, big sister.
I
had a twin sister, and she got into Blur and Oasis sort of during Britpop, and so I sort of followed on from her and then checked out. So it was the Britpop that really influenced me. I thought the Blur and Pulp and Oasis,
and it was a time where you couldn't just get into it lightly. You got so into it. I was thinking the other day, I don't think I was that into all the Britpop, and I remembered I was fucking hugely into it. I had a HMV import of a live Blur album, the Japanese one, I think it is, and things like that. And I was like, in my mind, I was into him for a bit, but with Blur and Pulp and everyone at that time, even if you're into him for a bit, you were heavily into them for
Totally.
For that period of time.
I just would get their CDs and just listen to the Super Furry Animals especially. I would just listen to them over and over again. And then as I got a bit older, I discovered, first of all, Steve Lamacq's show on Radio 1, which introduced me to some slightly more interesting indie music. And then I listened to John Peel's show on Radio 1 late at night. And that was the introduction to bands like the Velvet Underground and the Smiths and Pixies that I'd never heard before.
Effectively, all the bands you'd missed
at
that point. So it's great that John Peel is known for breaking new bands and for being this, but it was also, his show in general remained a historical show at the same time. He would have brand new stuff, and he would have stuff that's like, you should know this, and you know,
he just
a true education all round.
Yeah, he'd just stick on How Soon Is Now by the Smiths and then follow that up with like some girl who'd made a record in her bedroom and made one copy and sent it to John Peel and then reggae. It was It's a hard thing to talk about because so many people have told the John Peel story and know how influential he is. But that's why was so important to me, because I didn't have cooler friends or older friends or anything like that.
So you got to be the older sibling to guide you through this.
Yeah, yeah. And music stage is a massively important part of, everything I've done.
So when did you start writing, and what was your kind of birth into that? You grew up in Norwich, right?
No.
Where you're from originally? Or where?
I moved to Norwich when I was 18 to start university.
University
of East Anglia.
So where did you grow up?
A little town called Brigg in Lincolnshire, about half an hour from Lincoln.
Yeah.
A pretty little market town. Very nice. Still like going back there whenever I can.
Yeah.
Some really nice friends there. And they were my Britpop years.
Yeah.
And then I came to university. And so I never really wrote that much. I always wanted to be a writer.
Yeah.
I remember watching Roald Dahl being interviewed from his shed on Going Live one Saturday morning.
Amazing.
And I thought I'd quite like a job where I sat in the shed and wrote stuff. So I loved reading books, but in a sort of like, not in a serious sort of like bookwormy way, just like I was very happy, very contented when I had a book to read.
Enjoying a story, yeah.
Enjoy a story. And it was only when I started university, I did German as my degree.
Oh,
I did German and business studies.
Damn, that's a serious combination.
It's a very serious combination. There's a man on the roof.
There's a man at the window, yeah. There's some scaffolding outside. I believe, I'm not sure which part of the square are we at, because I noticed that they've just built a TGI Fridays store.
I got confused walking here because the building, I'm so simple, if just one bit of scaffolding, I suddenly think I have no idea, even though I've walked past this building a thousand times.
Anyway, that man's distracted us slightly, but it seems nice. Seems happy.
I could have just not mentioned him.
No, I like it. I think we're bringing the people in. There's always a excitement of, and particularly a scaffolder working in the rain. I mean, that must be terrifying.
I think you should interview the scaffolder for your next podcast.
We'll get him in next time. Yeah. He's probably too busy.
Yeah, he's scaffolding.
He's not like us writer types. he's just taking a day to go and sit around talking.
So I started the University of East Anglia doing German and business, but I joined the Creative Writing Society, because you didn't have to be part of the creative writing degree. Anyone could go to it, and it's just this room of people sitting around in a circle reading out stuff they'd written.
Yeah.
And I'd never written anything. I'd written some, I guess you would call them song lyrics or just poems that were in a notebook that I never thought were anything other than just my own amusement. And they were probably just terrible teenage, who knows what they were about.
Yeah.
Probably fancying girls.
I've refound some of them over recently. I guess that kind of counts as when I actually started writing poetry, because I wrote them as song lyrics, but I wasn't in a band.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I don't know what I thought they were.
I was the same. I'd written all my stuff as song lyrics, but there's no songs to go with these song lyrics.
And so Creative Writing Society, the first time I went, there was a guy who was in my year who read out this story he'd written, and it blew my mind. I thought it was the most incredible story, and that was Tim Clare, who we know now know is an incredible. He just had his first novel published, brilliant, one of the most amazing performers.
Again, another regular at Bestival, and just an amazing performer, and
unlike anyone else, really so original, so many like interesting ideas, and just funny, really
completely,
funny and rude.
Yeah,
and I said to him afterwards, like, that story was amazing. I said,
do you remember what it was about at all? What kind of story? Obviously, I don't want you to tell his whole story. But
It was about a brother and sister in a little town, and it was something he'd written for the Western Super Mayor short story competition.
Oh, wow.
But I just remember he just created this whole village, and he talked in such precise detail about, like, the trousers the little boy was wearing and, like, the church. And it was like, it was really exciting. And And he said to me, well, if you're interested in stories, you should write a story and read it out next week. So I went straight to my flat and wrote my first ever short story.
That's amazing. That's such an amazing and simple bit of advice. If you're interested in this, you should do that before next week.
Yeah.
Okay,
and so I came along the next week, and he said to me, I thought that was brilliant. Like, everyone, it seemed to be really positive. There's maybe like 15 people around in this circle, in this room. And he said, that was brilliant. I think you should just do a different story every week. And like, whenever you write something, email it to me. I'd really like to read it. And we had that relationship for like a year, really, just me and him. And there turned out to be lots of people who've now gone on to have writing careers. Like the year below, there was Joe Dunthorne and Luke Wright.
Submarine and
wrote Submarine. Doing,
yeah, amazing stuff.
Yeah, and Luke Wright was in our year who was doing lots of poetry gigs and hasn't stopped since.
No, literally hasn't stopped since and has had amazing successful runs at Edinburgh and running the Latitude Poetry Stage for a long time now. So yeah, that's a
and so I met all these
hell of a class.
Yeah, I met all these people as 18-year-olds and I was always a little bit distant from the group because I was really shy growing up. I was really shy as a teenager. I was quite happy hanging out with my sister and hanging out with my three or four friends and being in my room listening to Britpop and John Peel and watching football. Like, I was really content with that. Like, I wasn't shy as in like nervous about leaving the house. I just didn't have any desire. Didn't know how to communicate with the people. Just assumed they would have absolutely no interest in anything that I had to say. Which I still think is a valid point. And so these guys were going off doing really exciting things. And I just stayed in contact with them. And I would just write. And as I was watched their careers improve, I would sort of, everyone got better because the other people were getting better. And we all stayed, sort of became really good friends, which sort of leads us on to 2006. So that was 2000 when I started university when I was 18. And me and Joe Dunthorne and our friend Hannah Walker, who's now a very successful theatre maker and poet. Amazing. The three of a lot of people left, like London left, Luke left to go to London, Tim went back to Portishead. Lots of people moved around, but me, Hannah, and Joe were the three people that remained. And we used to meet up and write poems. We do this thing called speed poetry, where we go out to a pub, we drink, and we'd think of a title, and then we'd just not talk to each other. And for 10 minutes, we'd write a poem. And then we'd read the poems to each other, say what we thought, and then think of another title. And 10 more minutes, we'd write a poem. And we'd do it at a pub or at each other's houses, and we'd put music on and like get drunk, or we'd go to the park. And one day, Hannah said to me, "Oh, it feels weird that we've got all of these poems. We've got like 100 poems written in the last few months, and none of us have ever done a gig. So we've booked a cafe and we're going to do a gig. You're going to do 10 minutes. Joe's doing 10 minutes." Mm. Hannah said she was doing 10 minutes, and we'll get a few other people in as well. And so that was my first ever gig. I never wanted to do a gig. I never thought I would do a gig. That's not why I was writing poems. I was writing them to hang out with my friends and because I enjoyed it. And a minute before I was announced on stage, Luke Wright turned up late and drunk. Brilliant. As is very much his style.
Yeah.
And he saw me do my poems and he came up to me afterwards and said, "That was great. In 2 months, there's this festival starting up called Latitude. I'm booking the poetry tent. Do you want to come along and do some poets? I still need a couple more slots to fill."
Yeah.
So again, I didn't think anything of it. I just thought, I'll go along to Latitude, and had this amazing time at Latitude, like working out what poems to do.
Yeah.
And then someone in that audience came up to me afterwards and said, "That was great. I won this night at Whitechapel Art Gallery. Do you want to come to that?" And that's basically what I've been doing.
It just spread
ever since.
From there, I love that. And again, I love how interlinked and tight and knit it all is. And the fact there is, that was after your first ever gig, but that was also 100 poems deep into your career. So again, although you'd been doing it leisurely and for entertainment, it's kind of,
it looks now like it was like very much planned. Like it was a very, like a really good career plan of like just write loads and loads. So I do worry about, you must see these kids doing open mic now, these 18-year-old kids. And I always wonder whether that's a sensible thing to do. Because for some kids, it's absolutely fine. But I think if I'd done a gig when I was 18, it would have ruined my confidence, and I would have never gone on stage again and never tried again. But some 18-year-olds are more confident than I was as an 18-year-old.
I've got that there, but yeah. So, I mean, you kept very much in touch and connected with Luke, with Tim, and then with Ross Sutherland and Chris Hicks. Were you one of the founding members of Poetry's first ever a boy band?
No,
as it was dubbed.
That was Isle 16, and that was 16. Ross and Luke, and this guy Yanni.
Right.
I
remember Yanni.
Yeah, you don't forget Yanni.
You don't forget
Yanni. Once you've met him, he's a brilliant poet. He's sort of retired to the countryside now.
Yeah, yeah.
drinking his 4% cider in his shed, listening to Test Match Special. Perfect. It's very much my career goal.
Yeah, that's the dream.
That's the dream. And yeah, they formed, well, basically in the 2000, I think 1999 they formed it, because no one was doing poetry gigs. There was no, the scene now is huge, the spoken word scene. Yeah. No one was really doing it back then, and Luke had seen John Cooper Clarke, and Ross's dad was a big John Cooper Clarke fan.
Right.
And so they were very much influenced by John Cooper Clarke, and John Cooper Clarke was not really doing gigs at the time.
No.
He was sort of in his in-between years.
Yeah.
So the only way they could make gigs happen was to make them happen themselves. So they went up to Edinburgh all the time. They were always running nights in Norwich, and they ran a night on Sunday evenings, and when I was at university, and every Sunday evening I thought, I'm going to go along and do a poem.
Yeah.
But I also played football on Sunday evenings. And so every Sunday I would just think, oh, now I'll just go and play football.
Yeah.
And I always thought that's my opportunity missed, because I wasn't not courageous enough to go to this open mic gig, and I played football instead. But then luckily this sort of Latitude thing happened, and it all went on from there. And the important thing is we've always had such a nice time hanging out with your friends. So many of my friends
are good, because there is such a, I mean, are you guys all kind of came together when you started doing homework, which is a great night, which we definitely have to talk about. But the thing I always liked was, I do kind of associate all of you together. I always think of, and when I'm booking for Camp Bestival or Bestival, it's always awkward, because it's like, well, I've got these slots, but I don't want to, am I going to offend Ross if I don't book Ross, but I do book John or Tim and all this kind of thing. But there's such a variation in styles and approaches. So it's not just a group of poets who are all really similar at all. You can take your pick, and it'll be you'll get the same experience. There's such a variation and range in you.
I think that's how I got my style a little bit. At first I thought, well, I can't perform poetry because I'm not loud and confident, and I don't have this ability to rhyme like Luke does and Tim does.
Yeah.
And I thought that was my real weakness. But then I thought, well, actually, that'd be a terrible thing to do, because they already do that.
They're already doing that. It's covered.
And I remember
you can't get louder than Luke and Tim. They can compete on the loudness, but again, it's not worth entering that
and
fight.
They do compete on the loudness.
Yeah, they do.
That's when they're happiest. I also, because I'd not watched much poetry, I'd not read much poetry, so I didn't really know what I was doing, which again, I think is a strength of just people say, oh, I didn't really know what to expect. It's like, yeah, well, neither did I. Really.
No, I couldn't agree more. It's why I always often get asked to do school stuff and workshops, and I shy away from it, because I think, number one, I wasn't taught how to do any of this, and number two, I think a lot of people don't take into account how much of a skill teaching is.
Yeah.
It's a genuine and complex skill.
Yeah.
So in a way, I'm kind of not arrogant enough to think I can just stroll in and go, I'll show these kids how it's done. It's like, no, people like Polar Bear, and I'm sure Luke has done a lot of workshops and stuff like that. People like Polar Bear and Tempest and Luke and all that have got great techniques and have honed that skill. Whereas I always feel, you're booking me because I'm known as a spoken word artist, and I'll come in and go, so just write poems then.
Yeah.
That's what I do, just sit down and write.
That's what's,
it's not much of a lesson. Yeah. It's not much of a lesson. It's like, I can just email that to you. I can email that.
Yeah. Okay. Here's a playlist of Britpop songs. Open a bottle of wine. Have a nice time.
Enjoy yourselves.
Yeah. But that's interesting about Luke and Kate Tempest, is that although they're very so contemporary and so current and write about the world today, Luke's main influence is John Betjeman and Kate's main influence is William Blake. It's they know their stuff, and I don't know my stuff. Whereas something like writing books, I've written three books, which I feel like I feel happier in that world. I feel more confident and more a part of that world. And certainly for some reason, writing this sitcom has made me feel like script writing is the closest I've ever felt to being a writer. I think I know how that works, even though I've never had any training or I just feel like I have a grasp of it that I've not. I don't feel like I'm making it up as I'm going along, like I do with most of the rest of my life.
It's something that, and again, I'm only just kind of starting on some script writing, but it's something that as soon as you start, you kind of have to have a moment of annoyance that you've only just started
doing
this. Because it does, like the first thing I started to write, I was like, I've been putting this off for so long because I'm scared of not knowing what I'm doing and scared of the format. And it's so, I don't know, it feels incredibly natural. It's a form of writing that has kind of a distinct path in many ways, the bulk of it is having the idea and then seeing it through.
Yeah.
As weird as that sounds. Obviously, there's a lot more to it and a lot more complexities, but at the basis, it's that. It's going, right, here's my idea, now I need to write it. And that might end up shit, but you can complete a readable, feasible screenplay if you carry out those actions.
Yeah. And I'm just so fascinated with it. I love doing it. And yeah, I was lucky because Molly, who I wrote our sitcom After Hours with, had done an MA in script writing.
Yeah.
And so she could say, this is the thing, this is the program you need to download. And we both wrote...
What program do you write on?
Well, we used a free bit of software called Celtex, which is pretty good, which is great for beginners. But then we got Final Draft, which is quite expensive, but is really slick and nice to use.
And puts it all together.
Yeah, and it does things for you. And
again, the simplicity of you can have your characters all... Just all the different, the layout and format. Again, the first time I started one, I can't remember which one I'm using now, because I had another one recommended
Fade In.
And again, you're right, it does so much, or it takes so much of the scary stuff away.
Yeah.
It's like, right, there's a button to click, you can go, right, I'll make this an exterior, bang, 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 and then you're writing.
Yeah.
Are you writing dialogue at this point, or are you doing this? And it's like, it's crazy how simple it sets it all out.
Yeah, it's nice. Yeah. I've really, but I also think that one thing I really enjoy is not being a script writer, not being a novelist, not being a poet. I just like doing all of those things. Like, completely. I would never like to just have to only do one thing for...
I've said numerous times, I think a variation of options on your plate is a great way to get things done, because, I mean, it sounds stupid said this way, but I always feel the best way to finish a project is to have another project that you want to do. I can't think on that at the moment, so I'll work on this instead, and that kind of pushes you through. So have you, when you were writing the books you've written, were you balancing other things at the same time, or was that an undertaking? Because again, I mean, not to keep bringing him up, but Tim Clare is a great one on Twitter for giving advice to writers and advice on how to, and you know, for having a breakdown about how he's not getting this finished or not getting that finished. But again,
yeah, he does a blog, Death by a Thousand Cuts, which is one of the most fascinating blogs about writing and about being a writer and advice for writers. I feel like, when I first wrote my book, I started to write my first book at about the same time that I was first doing poetry. So it was that year after university when I was in Norwich. Joe Dunthorne was writing Submarine. I was writing a book called The Newsagent's Window. Do you know what happened? Because you're a fan of him. I read my sister bought me Dave Gorman's book.
Yes.
Are You Dave Gorman? Yeah. And I read it and... all in one go, I loved it so much. Like the conceit being that he tried to meet 54 people, all called Dave Gorman, which is such a stupid idea. But he made it so beautiful because he would meet people that he'd never have met otherwise. And so he would have to meet and shake hands with each Dave Gorman. And there was one section, one of the Dave Gormans, he emailed him and said, I need to meet all of these Dave Gormans, can I meet you? And so he said, come round to my... I'm working all day, but come round to my house when I'm on my lunch break and I can meet you then and you can have a game of Scrabble if you like. And so he met... Dave Gorman went round and played Scrabble with this other Dave Gorman and the Dave Gorman's wife.
Yeah.
And he said they played Scrabble on their lunch break every day for like 20 years. They'd have the same lunch break and they'd go home, play a game of Scrabble... and then go back to work. Amazing. And he showed Dave Gorman the logbook of every scorecard they'd ever had.
That's amazing.
And it was just like this document of like domestic bliss, really. Yeah. And
balance.
So Are You Dave Gorman is such a like silly idea, like, and it had these beautiful moments. And I thought
he's a master of, again, a lot of people can say easily, oh right, he just comes up with an idea and then
yeah,
it's that. But it's like, well, no, it's not. It's no coincidence that he comes up with ideas that always have amazing stories. And yeah. Amazing. Part of that is because he's an amazing writer, and part of that is just how he is as a human. I think putting himself in these situations and finding this.
He asks the right questions and he wants stories. And
yeah,
so I read Are You Dave Gorman, and I just thought, this is such an incredible book. And then I saw, I was outside a newsagent's, and I saw all of the cards in the window. And I thought, Dave Gorman's next book should be called The Newsagent's Window, and he should just reply to all of those cards of people selling their cars, people offering massages, people giving, selling their exercise bike.
Yeah.
He should go and meet those people, and that'd be a really interesting book, because these people are inviting you into their homes. Yeah. And it was about 2 weeks until I suddenly thought, hang on, I really want to write a book.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the way to do it.
Yeah, I've had an idea of a book that I would want to read.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe I should write that.
Yeah,
maybe other people will want to read it.
Yeah, and so I wrote 3 chapters and I decided to try and find an agent, probably after advice from Tim Clare.
Yeah.
And I sent it to 3 or 4 different agents, and I got one response from an agent who just said, this sounds great, do you want to come and meet me? And I didn't know that happened. I just thought it was universal rejection.
Yeah.
And so suddenly I found myself in coming to London, which was quite rare for me back then.
Yeah.
And I had a meeting with an agent who just said, I think this is a great idea for a book. I think you should write it. I'll help you with it. And then we'll try and get you a book deal. Yeah. And so for the next year, I wrote this book. But that was also when I was writing poems with Joe and Hannah.
Yeah.
And so I'd have I worked at Anglia Windows at the same time as well. So I had sort of a 9-to-5 job.
Yeah.
And then my evenings and weekends.
A hell of a lot of writing.
It was a hell of a lot of writing. But again, because I really loved it and because I wanted to know what happened with this book. And so I ended up getting a book deal for the Newsagent's Window. And it was a book deal for 2 books, and the other one was about radio. Well, in the meeting at the publishers, they said, do you have any other ideas for a book? And I said, well, I've always wanted to write a book about radio where every chapter is a different radio station. And they basically said, all right, we want you to do that book now.
Yeah.
So I had to do that book first. So the book that I spent a year on, we spoke about for 5 minutes in this meeting. And then the book that I'd sort of scribbled down, they were like, can you spend the next year of your life doing that? And so I wrote
The one I've just spent.
Yeah. Which is amazing. So yeah, so I wrote a book about radio, and it's Book of the Week on Radio 4.
Amazing.
When that happens, you think, well, that's my career sorted.
Yeah.
Turns out not to be the case, but it's a fun week while it happens.
Yeah. I can't think if it was on the podcast or in normal life. I was discussing this the other day.
Normal life?
Things in normal life. Yeah. Non-podcast life. Where you do have those things. And I remember talking to someone just before going on the Joe Rogan podcast, which I'm a massive fan of his podcast, and I know it gets millions of listeners. And they were saying to me, yeah, it's exciting, it's amazing, and then it's happened, and then life's normal again. And it was one of them of you have those certain things that you think, well, this, wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's it now.
Yeah.
I'm set. And it's like, well, no, that is, you shouldn't underplay how amazing that is still. That is still an amazing thing, but it might not be the life-changing thing that you... Or, let's be blunt about it, the financial life-changing thing that you expect these things to be. Because it is a weird one, because it is still life-changing that you were booked for the... That's amazing.
And then you think back to watching Roald Dahl on Going Live when you were 7 years old, and you think, oh, I have done what...
Yeah.
But because you're involved in so many different things...
Deeper you're into it, the more the goalposts are moved, constantly and constantly. I sent this to, this is going to sound like awful name dropping now, but when Adele's first album came out, I sent her a message, and similar with Kate Nash, because both of them I'd gigged with for a while and thought were amazing. And then when they got signed, their albums were suddenly going to be a huge deal and chasing number one and all this kind of thing. And sent them a message just saying, look, in the middle of all this, and particularly now you wrote the album months ago, you've now been in the middle of this promo thing forever, take a minute to realise you've got a record in a shop.
That's the best
amazing
advice.
I remember the first time I spoke to Adele on MySpace, we'd both, I think Adele had joined on I think it was on the first night she had joined, someone had pointed to one of my pieces, 1,000 Words, and we were talking, and at that point she was about to go to uni and was going to stop doing music for a bit to focus on uni.
Mm.
And I remember at that time, again, having no influence, but saying, I don't know, man, you seem to be getting yeah. some traction. You should stick it out. Like, both things could wait. You know, it's an option. Yeah. You could say, I'll defer uni for a year and do music for a year. Because I'd done that of quitting my job and spending a year doing this. So I remember at that point just saying, you know, that could be worth going at this music lark.
Yeah.
And then obviously that all turned into to wherever it has. But yeah, having that moment.
Did you send her a message on MySpace saying, I think...
You're welcome.
I think you'll be doing the James Bond theme in 5 years'
yeah,
time.
Yeah, yeah, it's worth persisting and then go to uni. But just that thing of everything, then the goalposts get moved and take a minute to step back and go, I've got a record in a shop.
Yeah.
How amazing is that? And
yeah.
again, you think of literally a year before, I've got a record that's actually out and on the shelf in HMV. I know that's changing now as physical records are dying off, but still, that moment of that. So, again,
which
before,
is why I enjoy Bestival, really. Like, you do try, yeah. and Latitude, you do try and take a moment to look around and go, oh, things can't be going too badly. This
yeah.
is this,
I'm here
this is
and
all
I'm
right.
I'm being paid
so
to
far.
Be here. It's
yeah.
insane.
Yeah.
But, so yeah, so you've now had... three books.
Yeah.
So, again, what made you kind of drift towards screenwriting rather than novels?
It's because I did a show called John Peel Sheds.
Oh, yeah. I mean, let's get on back. I'm going to change the questions constantly as we discuss things
yeah.
here. But it's something I wanted to discuss as well. Your Edinburgh Fringe show.
Yeah.
That was the first one that I saw get a lot of love and attention.
Yeah.
Was about... the radio,
yeah,
and I said the book that you pitched as a second option
yeah.
was the one that got excited about and about our radio and now the TV show. So, are they all
the trilogy?
Are they? Yeah, are they a Cornetto trilogy, a Peel trilogy of sorts? Or
it sounds like the most boring trilogy, the radio trilogy,
the radio trilogy,
the what a slightly awkward man in his early 30s thinks about radio trilogy.
What a trilogy.
It is. Yeah, they are all interconnected because the book about radio, I wrote about, like, sort of my, obviously, John, there's a chapter about John Peel in there. And that's where I first wrote about this box of records that I won. In 2002, I won a box of records from John Peel's, on John Peel's Radio 1 show.
Yeah.
He did this random competition where anyone listening could write in. He wanted people to write in to say why they enjoyed listening to his show.
Yeah.
And he said the person with the best answer would win a box of records from his shed. It was obviously with the Sony Awards that they were eligible for, and there was one of the parts of the entry form was, why do people listen to your show? And
right.
so they thought, instead of writing that That's themselves, awesome. They would get the listeners
yeah, yeah,
to do
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I love that.
And so this is, again, like a complete chance, a bit like I said about other things about writing the sitcom, that I happened to be listening to it that night, and I wrote down the line, I wrote down, records you want to hear played by a man who wants you to hear them. And I had an envelope and a stamp on my desk, and I went out and posted it, like, there and then.
Yeah.
I think if I hadn't had an envelope and stamp, I would have just, like, thrown it in the bin the next day. I would have just looked at it and thought, why did I write that
yeah.
weird sentence?
Yeah.
And then a couple of weeks later, these... two of John Peel's friends turned up in a van with my records.
Amazing.
And so I had these records for 10 years in my front room, just thinking, like, just getting them out occasionally and playing them. And it was frustrating that it was such a magical, important significant box of records. And I needed to do something with them. So I took them along to a radio studio in Norwich, where I live. Future Radio, a really cool community radio station. And I said to them, this girl Simone, who worked there, can I do a show where I just play some records from this collection from John Peel? And she helped me do it. And she basically a studio like we're in now. And she just taught me how to use the software. She's the one who taught me that headphones are called cans.
Excellent knowledge.
And so I made these 5 podcasts, and they were broadcast on this radio station where I just played the music, played my favourite tracks from the collection. And talked about the bands in between. And this guy came up to me in Edinburgh, who I knew a bit, called Tom Searle, who had a production company called Show and Tell. And they were working he was working at the time with Luke, and he was working with Laura Dockrill and Simon Munnery, and he's now doing stuff with Josie Long and Tony Law and Ross as so well.
On loads of stuff. I remember him putting on Stephen Merchant on one of his early runs of that. So yeah.
Yeah. And he said to me, I just listened to your podcasts. You do realise that would be an amazing Edinburgh show. And this was a conversation in Edinburgh as well, yeah. at the Underbelly. And he just said, if you write a script, I will produce it and do all of the boring bits.
Brilliant.
And so I wrote it sort of that week in Edinburgh. Because I quite like writing stuff when I'm surrounded by creative things going on. Do you find that?
Yeah, completely. I found it. I've only been to Edinburgh Festival once, but it blew me away just being surrounded by all that. I got the most writing done, I got the most work done, and just felt...
Yeah. You were really disciplined at Edinburgh, weren't you?
Yeah, I didn't really party at all. Yeah. I gigged every night and wrote every morning.
Yeah.
But I'd also go and see shows as much as I can. And it's where I saw Ross's... what was his rewind?
Stand By For Tape Backup,
which is still one of the best live things I've ever seen.
It's incredible.
It just blew me away.
Yeah. I bumped into you on your way back from that.
Right, yeah.
You were walking back to the Pleasance Dome after seeing that, and it was like I've just seen this thing.
And again, it's a weird one with things like that, because obviously I know... you know Ross all the better. So it's like, you're very aware, but I still need to tell you how amazing this is. I know you're very aware how amazing this is, but wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was great.
So I wrote the script for John Pritchard, took it to Edinburgh the next year, and it sold out the entire run.
Yeah.
Radio 4 came to watch it. It got 5-star reviews. It was just this ridiculous response. And so that meant that Radio 4 put it on the radio, and that meant that I started to have meetings, and so I started to have, suddenly there was, because at the time I'd done 2 books and some poetry stuff, but none of them were particularly big, even though they'd had bits of success, but I was still pretty much a nobody.
Yeah.
So I was having meetings for the first time.
Too enthusiastically with that.
You were a nobody, yeah. Is that in your notes? Why? Make sure you mention these. Make sure you remind him that he was a nobody and is now like one notch above. And you can go back to being a nobody quickly. Yeah. Just one bad podcast.
It's a removable notch.
And so that it was at the same time that I met up with Molly. I lived with Molly for a couple of years. We both lived in Norwich, and we were both looking for a new place to live at the same time. And so we said, let's get a flat together. So we lived together for 2 years, and then she moved out, and I went to do John Peel's Shed. And I just got a text from her one day saying, hey, we haven't hung out for a while. Let's go to the cinema. Let's get a curry. Let's go to the pub. So we did all of those. Yeah, that's what we do in Norwich. And we had this sort of like midnight discussion on, after drinking lots of rum, just saying, what are your plans for next year? I said, I don't know. What are your plans? Sort of said, well, why don't we do something together? And she said, if you could write anything, what would it be? And I said, a TV sitcom. Mm. She said, that's what I want to do as well. And she said, what would it be about? And so all I knew is I wanted it to be about radio. I thought, if we can capture the essence of what I had in John Peel's Shed, and not so much what was in John Peel's Shed, but the conversations I had with people who enjoyed the show, they would just say, because what I'd written in John Peel's Shed was pretty...
I do need to reaffirm that the show was called John
Peel's Shed.
To capture what I had in John Peel's Shed.
It's a different thing, yeah.
Yeah.
And so what the material I wrote for John Peel's Shed was pretty much irrelevant. People saw the records and they saw the record player, and they were just transported back to their own times of music that was important to them, late night radio that was important to them. They were all different ages, so it might be that they were remembering stuff they'd heard on MySpace, or it might be that it was John Peel or thousands of other radio presenters. Lots of people had never heard of it. It wasn't a show about John Peel at all, really. It was about that feeling of hearing the Smiths for the first time, hearing just that special band. What was that for you? What was the most exciting musical epiphany?
I mean, this is going to be... initially, it was Hendrix, which feels like a perfectly reasonable one, but the two bands that made me fall completely in love with music were Green Day and Rancid.
Okay.
So Green Day haven't a frowned upon a bit now, but again, at that time at school with Dookie had just come
Dookie
out
was
and the
exciting,
other albums
yeah.
and things like that. It was just such a, wow, this is amazing. This is the most exciting thing in the world. And I think I'm sure I started with them and went backwards of then into the Pistols and the Clash and all these others that meant the world to me as well. But yeah, I'd say them two have to stand out at the time as that moment. But
so that's what we wanted to do, is to create that kind of teenage excitement of falling in love and listening to music and sort of how those two things are related.
It's such a weird thing how it is. You generally have that in your teens or at college or wherever that is the time. As an adult, you'll get into music, but not quite in the same way where you're listening over and over and over and over and obsessed.
And so we came up with this idea of having a sitcom about an 18-year-old boy. First episode, he gets dumped by his beautiful girlfriend, and he's devastated. But especially if your beautiful girlfriend is Georgina Campbell.
Yeah, I mean, I did feel so bad for him.
Yeah, and he played that so well. Like, just, we wanted everyone to just go back to that moment your heart breaks when you're 18.
Amazingly simple as well. Just very simple and straightforward, just that moment.
Just her going, sorry, and him going, oh, didn't know that was the plan. I thought it was all fine. And so we just talked about who these characters would be. Molly and I, so this is sort of November of 2011, and it's the two things. One is like talking about an idea in a pub when you're a bit drunk, but the most exciting thing is the next morning when you wake up and think, that was a really good idea. Yeah, you don't feel embarrassed.
Yeah.
And so we sort of met up the next day and it's like, this is good, isn't it? This is really exciting. So we went to her mum and dad's in Cornwall for the first week of January. We spent in Falmouth and we just wrote, I didn't write any script, we just wrote the character, explored every character. Brilliant. This is what Molly brought to the table that I would never have done. She was like, what GCSEs did they do? What colour hair have they got? What does the mum do for a living? What does the dad do for a living? What are their motivations? All that kind of thing. It was so exciting. And we just watched loads of TV that we thought was similar in theme to stuff we wanted to do. And we went and wrote the first script, and we were so excited to do it. And we both wrote the first scripts separately.
Yeah.
And then we sort of merged it into this one mega document.
Nice. Yeah.
And we thought it was great. And we spent like 6 months just working on it. And then it's really weird, another weird coincidence. I'd done John Peel Shed at Soho Theatre. And this guy, who I think you know, Jeff Lloyd, brilliant radio presenter, came along. And I'd met Jeff a couple of times. He'd been really supportive of me when I was writing my radio book. When I interviewed someone from the Radio Times about radio for my radio book, they said, you have to listen to Jeff Lloyd's show. He's the best person on radio. He's so funny and interesting. And
he really is. He's, for anyone who's not heard, he's on Absolute, and he's just got a really good... just a good way about him.
He's got a good
general
way about him.
Yeah, it's just, it's enjoyable and lovable. He gave me my most uncomfortable moment. I was...
He will have done.
We weren't even in the same room, but I was driving along. I pulled over to do a tweet. I didn't. I was in traffic. It was bad. Yeah. I shouldn't. But I was driving along and the new cult... There was a Coldplay Christmas song. So this was probably 2-3 years ago. They had some Christmas song. And I just tweeted saying how, I can't remember what it was, I think something about it sounding like a David Brent song. It genuinely wasn't attacking, because Coldplay are so easy to attack. But it was saying something about how I didn't like it. And the song ended, and I heard Jeff Lloyd say, that was the new one from Coldplay, and that's especially for Scroobius Pip. I know he's a big fan. And realised that he follows me on Twitter.
Yeah.
Just that weird... that weird moment of realising that Twitter and all these things are so public and there are people doing it, it is all interlinked, just really brought... because you send tweets and you don't really think about it being in the real world.
It's
you think
weird,
it's
isn't
just,
it?
It's on your phone.
Yeah.
So when it had that immediate affirmation of... what?
How come Jeff Lloyd stolen my phone?
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, sorry, that's Jeff Lloyd.
And so he did a radio show. He did his show every day, but he used to do a show on Sunday evenings called Unknown Pleasures, where he just played cool, interesting music like the Smiths and also new bands, new indie bands. I listened to it as much as I could. And the first 15 seconds of it was the song After Hours by the Velvet Underground. Mm-hmm. It's a really beautiful, sweet song.
Yeah.
And it always really struck a chord with me. I always liked hearing it. And I thought that would be a great title for our sitcom. It would be a really good theme tune.
Yeah.
And so I said this to Jeff. I met up with Jeff after doing John Peel Shed, because he came along to watch that. And just having that nice conversation of what you're up to. And I was like, I'm doing this book, I'm doing this, I'm doing this. And I said, oh, me and my friend Molly have just started writing this sitcom. And it's called After Hours because of your radio show and because you play After Hours at the start of your Sunday night show. And he said, well, I can't really take credit for that because there's a guy called Craig Cash who wrote The Royal Family. And he used to do a radio show in Manchester in the 80s. And it was my favourite radio show. And he said he started every show with the first 15 seconds of After Hours by the Velvet Underground. I just nicked it from him.
Just passed on.
And he said, I met up with Craig recently and he's got his own production company. And he said he's on the lookout for scripts for sitcoms. So if you want to, you can send me your scripts. And if I think it's the kind of thing he'd like, I'll forward it to him. So I emailed it to him, and 2 days later, me and Molly got an email from Craig Cash going, hi guys, Jeff sent me your script. I love it, and I promise you I'm going to make sure it's on TV.
That's amazing.
So suddenly me and Molly went from being these two people who were sort of like, didn't really know what we were doing with this sitcom, just apart from just enjoying it and making it really good, and knowing that at some stage we would send it out. Craig Cash was emailing us saying, when can I meet you? I want to talk to you on the phone. Amazing. So Molly spoke to him on the phone at 1:30 the next day. We arranged it to be at 1:30. Then about 2:30, she texted me and she said, get to my house ASAP. So I had to bike to her flat and she was outside on the front doorstep with a cigarette. And she just said, he wants to meet us. He wants to work with us. He wants to make it as amazing as possible. And he thinks he can get it on TV.
That's awesome.
And he did.
And he did. And he did.
Yeah.
How much, from watching it, three episodes, hasn't there been? Three episodes so far. Or this will be going out in December, so it might have been sometime in December. So there would have been more. But one of the things that struck me was how distracted you could get when writing it by choosing which songs you're going to have in and play. Because it's a construct that allows you to nerd out as a music fan.
Totally.
So it allows you to go, right, now we'll just have this song and they'll all enjoy it or sing along or whatever. How distracting was that? And how much, were there any songs that you had to change from your original idea of what you're going to play? Because again, it's one thing to write it down. Yeah. It's another thing to get it cleared and get it in there.
At first, we assumed that we wouldn't be allowed to even name the song. So in our script, it just said, cool music plays.
Right, brilliant.
It's like, Lauren puts on a song by an interesting sounding band. And then Craig said to us, oh, it would really help me if you just put like your absolute ideal choice of song at each moment.
Yeah.
And then we'll worry about clearance later on. And also, by this stage, Sky One were interested because they do really interesting comedies. And he said, Stuart Murphy, who works at Sky, has got really good taste in music. So, like, he will really get it. And so we don't have to worry about...
So it can become a selling point. So if you're reading the script and then the songs that are coming up are songs that you love, then that's going to get you even more on board.
Well, Ardal O'Hanlon, or Father Dougal, as you know him... one of the reasons that he took the role is because he just looked at the songs in the script and just thought, wow, these are not like Blister in the Sun by the Violent Femmes is there. And he just thought, that's my favourite song from being a teenager. I can't believe there's a script with Violent Femmes. And there were a few songs that we weren't allowed. One song that I really wanted was Sage Francis, The Best of Times.
Yeah.
But couldn't get clearance for certain songs. But actually, a lot of them, we've got Modest Mouse, we got clearance for, and the Pixies.
I can't believe
and
Sage didn't allow it.
I think it was probably nothing to do with Sage. Yeah. Like, it's the sort of thing that if we'd fought for, we probably could have like got to him eventually. Because I did think, maybe I'll just send yet another email to Scroobius.
Yeah, Sage, just give me a shout.
dear Mr. Pip.
But what a beautiful song as well. But yeah, I can understand that. Again, I know how people can be, particularly independent artists, can be particularly cautious of scenes and things like that. And
Arctic Monkeys just don't license any of their music. I really respect them for that as well.
Fine, isn't it?
But luckily, we were allowed some amazing... In After Hours, I think one of the great... The brilliant actors, but the music, I think, is the other strongest selling point.
Yeah.
And I think in the six episodes, we've got things like The Mountain Goats, Hefner, who were my favourite band as a teenager... Yeah. We've got a Damon Albarn solo track, Modest Mouse, The Smiths, Pixies, and just have it. Baby Shambles did a cover of the Velvet Underground song as well.
Yeah.
Pete Doherty just like really, like it's amazing. He did it especially for us.
Oh, especially for it. Again, I'd heard it obviously in the show, but yeah.
It's brilliant. And so, yeah, that was really exciting, like just coming up with those songs. And those, but also, we had to agree on it, Molly and I. We've got really similar taste, which was lucky.
Yeah.
And Craig has got really similar taste as well.
Yeah.
So, and yeah, so sometimes doing the edit, it was quite hard. We had to find the perfect song. But also, Sky, we thought at some stage Sky would say, you can't just have these little indie bands in your show. You've got to have it bigger. But they've just let us, at every stage, they just let us do what we wanted.
It's interesting because, again, it is, it's, yeah, I guess it's weird. It, at no point did it cross, in the three episodes I've seen, at no point did it cross my mind that it's little indie bands or whatever, because it was all songs that I was so familiar with anyway.
Yeah.
So it's one of them. It's like, I was thinking, God, this must have cost a fortune to get all these cleared. Yeah. And then you realise, well, no, actually, this isn't the kind of stuff that would necessarily cost a fortune to get it all cleared. It is the more obscure and more unusual. It just happens to be similar to what I grew up listening to or whatever else.
Yeah, there's a band called The Lovely Eggs who are in it, one of my favourite bands. And I think
I sampled them on my on Distraction Pieces on my solo album.
Oh, really?
So on the song Death of the Journalist, it was produced by Zane Lowe, and he was a big fan of The Lovely Eggs.
Yeah.
And he put a sample of them, and it's just I'm a journalist from the short song. And we again I had to hit them up and go, I've only just found out where this was from. I really like it, but the album's coming out in a few weeks. Is it all right to
they do
or
it
I'm going
it.
To print? And I'm like,
they do it for a Patti Strong band,
exactly.
It's lovely people.
So
that was the real the really special thing about that show is the I do think that we did. Luckily, Craig Cash had worked in radio for a long time. He'd worked in pirate radio. He'd worked in genuinely, I think it was illegal pirate radio in the 80s, when that was like a real thing. This is just like a legal show that streams on the internet. So there's nothing illegal about it. They just do it on a boat because they happen to have a boat.
Well, I mean, we're recording this. A Radio X, formerly XFM, have kindly lent me their studios to record this, and they started off as a pirate, as an illegal, hidden station kind of thing. And
it's exciting, isn't it? It's the thought that people would risk prison sentences to put the radio.
If people haven't heard it, and if you haven't heard it, when I had John Kennedy on, it's one of the best podcasts I've ever had because he's such a historian of radio. And if you're got any interest in radio at all, this isn't just hugging my podcast, because also I think it's the podcast I speak the least on, because I'm just sat there in awe of John just telling this story of the birth of XFM, his involvement of when he used to work in the BBC audio library. The BBC gramophone library. So literally just catalogues and catalogues of just the most amazing music that at that point regional BBC stations would request to take out, and you'd send it off, so it's the same record going around all these just amazing stuff. But
I've
gone off track there, but I recommend that one.
But there's so many, like, I can just absorb these stories about radio. I think there's something so magical about it, and especially pirate radio in the 60s. Like listening to the Velvet Underground late at night is just beautiful.
It's definitely it's exciting because obviously tonally it's very different, but it reminded me of a similar thing that This Is England was so good at, of allowing, and again, it might seem in some way like a cheap trick, but allowing all the emotions you already have in you because of certain songs, all the work that's already been done there, using that to draw you in that bit quicker and that bit to make you completely committed and relating to these characters in this show, because they've gone, here's this song, I know that song means to you what it meant to me.
Yeah.
Also means to you what it means to these characters who are fictional, but now they're not, because they're feeling exactly the same as you feel about these songs.
That was a massive influence, This Is England 86.
Yeah.
I think it was just 86 had been out by the time when we were writing it. And just the way that they do those, Shane Meadows montages are so incredible. And
absolutely,
and that gang mentality, what's what we really wanted. We like to think of it as, well, the two taglines we like for our sitcom is, one is, it's a sitcom for six music listeners.
Yeah.
And the other is that it's sort of like the nicer side of of This Is England, or like the less dangerous side of This Is England. And that's what Jamie Winston, when she first read the scripts, she really loved about it, because she said that she was like turning the page because she couldn't wait to find out what the twist was, or like, when's it going to all turn bad? And then she got to the end and she thought, it doesn't have to go bad. And then she just had to read it again with this.
I love that. I love that writing at the moment. Brett Goldstein and John Drever, who did Super Bob, and numerous others. It's a real skill, I think, to write. I think in many ways, I don't think I could do it. I think I need to have a dark twist. I need to turn it somewhere. But it's a huge skill to write stuff that is just, it remains nice. And there are twists and turns along the way, obviously. But
it's intriguing. It's not just people like really enjoying a cup of tea.
It's nice. Everything's great.
Yeah, it's those people about to go out and it starts to rain, so they go, oh, we'll just stay in.
I'm close already credits. Torn on who I hope a Willow ends up with, who's the main character in it. I'm already torn.
Yeah.
But again, I don't know if that's, it's tough. But we won't go into, like, I don't want to, you know, get too deep into that. I want to ask, you were saying how you spent, Molly spent a lot of time really getting into these characters when you're writing them, their GCSEs, everything. How was it during the casting process, or even just seeing it on the screen? Because Jamie Winston, you mentioned, amazing coup and such a great actress. And
she's brilliant. Craig suggested her very early on.
Yeah.
And her and Willow were the two... it was really hard to cast all of them because the characters were so specific.
I was going to say, as you were saying that earlier, I was thinking on other things, on bits I've been working on, I've almost gone the opposite direction on certain characters. Yeah. It's like, right, I want to write it, but then I want to just find that person and not be put off because they're not at this. So did any of that come in? Was there any, well, Jamie Winston, yes, obviously she's amazing, but she's not the person that we've written, you know, anything like that, or for any of the others, obviously.
We're quite lucky. We the characters were so well drawn from a very early stage. It was never like we were thinking, well, this will be a Benedict Cumberbatch character, or this will be Martin Freeman. We were thinking, this is Lauren. This is what we've created. So we could see her in. It might be a problem if we're lucky enough to have a second series. Do we then go back to the Lauren that was in our head, or do we go to Jamie Winston? I don't know. But so we auditioned maybe 10 actresses for Lauren. Jamie was in LA, and so had sent a videotape in. So we already knew that we had her and that she was keen.
Yeah.
And no one, like all of the other actresses, were so good. But you had to be funny. You had to be so many different things. You had to look like you were in an indie band 10 years ago and hadn't quite recovered from it.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the actresses were actually like too good,
too polished.
Jamie just had this rawness that and the problem was with casting Willow.
Yeah,
Willow is the main character. Is an 18-year-old shy boy. And 18-year-old actors who come to auditions are not shy. They are confident.
Yeah.
And so either they were far too confident, or they were trying to play shy. They're trying to act as shy. And shy is a very hard thing to act, because you go too far. Absolutely. Like, it's not like I was saying about myself, that it's not like he's cripplingly shy. And so they were going for like cripplingly shy or confident. And so Craig Cash was saying,
there's a middle ground of...
Yeah, he's saying, well, maybe we're going to have to find someone who isn't an actor. Like, maybe it's just someone natural.
Again, it's the shame,
and it's completely.
It's what I've lucked out and traded off in the couple of acting roles I've had this year. The feedback I got on the auditions was, because both of them were kind of a medieval, they were saying, it's so hard because actors come in having to be grand and medieval, but because I didn't have any of that training, I just went in. They said, we want you to kind of do it in your own voice and just do it in the language that's here, but not being forsooth, you know, and being all or anything weird. And it was like, that's how I got the gigs in that one. Cause I didn't have those things to unlearn. If you know what I mean, I went in and just went, I'll read the lines. And then I left each audition thinking, I probably haven't got that. I literally just went in and said those words in my voice. But that's kind of what they wanted.
Yeah. And so, but luckily this kid called James Tarpey auditioned, and immediately, it was just like, Yes, him. Yes, 100% yes. Him. And we can't describe what it was. And actually, on screen, he looks so, he's so subtle. And yeah. Craig Cash was the person who gave James McAvoy his first TV appearance. Right. And there feels something similar with James McAvoy. Not wanting to hype up James Tarpey. But also, casting Ollie, it was just so exciting because it's a guy called Rob Kendrick, who's not done a great deal of TV before. A lot of the cast have not done a great deal of TV before, which is something we were really keen to get. Just this, we didn't want people to go, oh, that's the guy from Peep Show. That's the girl I saw her as a, like a waitress in.
So they are your characters. They're our characters, And there's the pulling together and excitement. I had Kurt Sutter on 2 weeks ago, and he was talking about when he started writing on The Shield, and he went on to do Sons of Anarchy and The Bass Executioner and Southpaw and loads more. But on The Shield, it was exciting because almost everyone from crew to cast were all kind of new at it and kind of blagging it a bit. Yeah. There were a few there to steady the ship, but there was so much where they were just all in it together. And there's no, in that situation, there's no one that's looking down on anyone else or questioning anyone else's place. You're all more just, right. What do we do? Let's make this work. And that can bring the best projects out.
Yeah, totally. And also, I think one thing we really wanted with our sitcom is that it looks unlike anything else that's been on TV.
Yeah.
One of the reasons that happens is because our director of photography is a guy called Daff, who works very closely with Craig. And he's like this BAFTA award-winning, amazing director. He's just so interesting colours and positioning and very precise. So he makes it look so beautiful. The fact that we set it on a canal helps because they're so sexy. But Molly and I, because we didn't know how to write a sitcom, we weren't following kind of rules. We weren't following anything. We weren't drawing from experience of other sitcoms we'd done. It was just like fresh and new. And we had such an amazing time writing that sitcom. And it was so every time we met up, we were just making each other laugh. And it was like the most special time. And we really hope that comes across on the page. And if people...
It's great. It's definitely... I mean, what you were saying there about the direction and the cinematography, I guess, it does come through. I think it was in episode 3 when they're all around the dinner table. And humour-wise and the characters-wise, I was watching it thinking, this should remind me of Friday Night Dinner, which I think is a great thing that Channel 4 did with Tom Rosenthal and some really good people. I think it should feel like that, but just something about the feel, it didn't at all.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's like, it's still, I was watching, it's got the same kind of humour, it's so well written in a similar way, but something about the way it's shot and the way it's all presented, it feels unique in that way.
That's good, yeah. And also, I think a little bit because that's the only time in the whole series they sit around that dinner table.
Yeah.
So it's not like, oh, and now it's the...
Now it's
someone on Twitter messaged me, Molly, last night after episode 3 and just said, I love that it's so pure and natural and there's no wacky neighbour. And I think there's been some great wacky neighbours in sitcoms, but it's just, I've never had a wacky neighbour.
No, I'd love it if it was awkward and you're like, oh God, episode 4 is when we introduce the wacky neighbour.
Although I think you'd be a great wacky neighbour if we get a second series.
Yeah, I think it needs to be shoehorned in, you need a wacky neighbour. Well, I mean, we've gone comfortably over an hour now, so I'll start to wrap up. What's the plan going forward? I'd imagine at the moment you're just revelling in the fact that you've got a bloody sitcom on TV.
Yeah, I've really been really enjoying the fact that it's out because we filmed it 18 months ago, so it feels like it's all been a long time coming.
Yeah.
I love that Molly and I are writing quite a few new little things at the moment, just sort of like developing ideas. We're desperate for a second series.
Yeah.
That would be really exciting because we think we just know we could make it really good.
Yeah,
we can take the characters really, because all of the actors are so talented. We know that we can just give them anything.
And
to
it's
do.
The beauty of when, as said, you've spent all that time on building the characters with so much information that hasn't even made it on screen yet.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Is that you can have confidence that before you've even got a plan of what the next series' main story arcs will be, it's like, I know these characters have got so much that you don't know about them yet that we've not been able to get in because
that's actually, we were commissioned to write the first 3 episodes and then there was a long time until Sky commissioned episodes 4, 5 and 6.
Right.
So for ages, Molly and I were just going, we want to, we were like fans, we're going, we want to be able to write episodes 4, 5, and 6 so that we know what happens to them. So yeah, we're doing that. I'm doing, I'm writing a new book, which I never thought I'd do again because I thought it was such a, I thought I'd done with books. I thought it was a fun thing that I'd done in the past, but I had a really good idea. So I'm now trying to do
Dave Gorman wasn't up for writing it, so.
I'm going to try, that's my thing for the next few weeks, is just knuckling down with that. And then just, hopefully, just do more and more poetry gigs. I find that I'm enjoying it more than I ever have done, really. Yeah. Like writing poems and doing, going along from place to place.
It's amazing to have that variation. And I think it's something to cross over between the lot. Because from a lot of the writers I know, the thing that starts to send them absolutely insane, and a lot of writers are insane, is that it's largely, or often, obviously a bit different if you're writing in a collaborative partnership, it's largely something that you do on your own, and in secretion, and you knuckle down. And the beauty of your balance is you're going to have a lot of that, because that's the nature of writing, but then you also have another part that is still your professional life and still your creative life that you get to go out and do in front of people and engage with people and have that engagement. Whereas, a lot of writers, it's that knuckle down, and then if they're going out, it's to blow off steam. And that can be where it can all start to fall apart and crumble. So it's a great combination to have that balance.
Yeah, and I've got three, really, because I've got that, and I've got writing on my own stuff, and then just working with, like, I guess you had this with Dan, but just working with one of your friends and just going around with them, and it's such such a privilege and such a luxury. And so you want to make sure
it becomes a shared and exciting thing. It becomes a shared thing. And go, can I look at this?
Because we were lucky enough to be on set every day of the sitcom, and we were just sitting next to each other, and
And the great part there is there's someone that you can be excited about and not be boasting.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
know what I mean? You can't text all your mates going, this has just happened. Yeah. There's going to be a point where they're going, all right, I'm at work, mate. Chill out. But there's someone that you can actually have all that excitement with who's equally excited and go, they've just commissioned 3 more episodes.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Yeah, I've got such happy memories of all of those, like the big points of building up to it, and also being there and then watching the first episodes a couple of weeks ago at our friend's house was just, it's like, yes. It was like shaking hands and going, well done. Let's do it again. Let's keep doing it.
So where can people keep up to date with you and all of your doings?
I've got a website called johnosbornewriter.com.
Excellent.
And Twitter, John Oz Radiohead.
John Oz Radiohead.
Which I don't like that as a Twitter handle, but when I started it, it's because I was only going to tweet about radio, because my book had just come out about radio.
Yeah.
So now I'm just lumbered with it.
It's like early email addresses. Isn't it? When people were early onto Twitter, it was always for a specific thing. I think for me, I just started my club night, and I was like, I'm worried. I don't know what this social network is, but I need to be on there to promote stuff. And then, but thankfully, I chose Rubius Pip Yo. Still,
it's fine. When you're 70, it might be.
Yeah, it'd be awkward. But at the moment, I can still wear high top trainers and jumpers with lions on, so I'm fine. I'm getting by. Well, thank you very much for coming on. It's been a delightful chat. Hey,
thank you for having me. I hope this has been all right.
Yeah, it's been absolutely lovely, and I look forward to watching the rest of the series and hoping for a follow up.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Thank you very much, sir.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Pieces.
That was John Osborne. What a lovely dude. Was great to chat with him. I'm a big fan of the guy, and I've said numerous times with this podcast, the podcast is a great opportunity at times to catch up with people that I generally only get to see in work situations or at festivals or whatever else. So it was lovely to sit down and have a good chat with John, a fascinating dude, and to give you an extra free podcast this week. As I mentioned, I think I mentioned in the outro of the Richard Herring podcast last week, or this week, double December. I find him so inspirational, because he's not someone that I see as a real go-getter or a networker, kind of a hustler. He's not that guy. He's a really nice, friendly dude, but he's not someone that strikes me as going out and getting business meetings and hustling. But
he's absolutely killing it. He's had, as we discussed, he's had three books and he's got a TV series, and it just seems to be going from strength to strength to strength. And that's purely off of his talent, his ability and his loveliness. I will also add that since we recorded that, I think it was in episode 4, cheeky little cameo from John Osborne in After Hours there. I was particularly excited to see him pop up buying, I believe, a cupcake and an orange juice. So yeah, that was nice to see. One of my questions I had planned was, do you intend to write yourself into anything that you do in the future? So it was then hilarious that he just popped up. I didn't get round to asking that because we got on so many different subjects. And then he just pops up, just buying a little cupcake and an orange juice, I think. So yeah, that was lovely. Next week's episode, really excited about this. It's the founder of a company called Ecotricity. And this is possibly the first company we've had on. And I discussed this in the podcast, so I won't go into it too much, but I've been approached numerous times to do sponsored guests. So a company would want one of their spokesmen or someone like that, who are a bit of a character, to come on and be a guest on the podcast. And I've turned them all down, and this isn't that. FYI, he's not a sponsored guest. It was a subject that I found fascinating, particularly with the climate summit that has been going on. So yeah, it's an interesting discussion. There's some interesting facts. I found it absolutely fascinating. I'd encourage you to listen if you aren't a silly hippie. I know it sounds like kind of hippie stuff, and silly hippie, I'm saying that in a joking way. I'm not really having a go, but there was a lot I went into sceptical, and some still, again, we have discussions. There's some bits we don't 100% see eye to eye on, but 90% of it, you know, we do. There's bits that I'm sceptical of, and then he reasons with me articulately and intelligently and from an informed base, which is the most important part. And yeah, he's spot on, man. So, yeah, I recommend you check that one out next week. It's a very good one. For this time of year as well, because it's quite heartwarming. It's also physically warming because it's about electricity and energy and power. So you could learn some stuff to actually be physically warm as well as emotionally warm. So check that out. You will enjoy it. I swear down. I've been Scroobius Pip. You can find me at Scroobius Pipio on Twitter and Instagram, or facebook.com/Scroobius Pip. So yeah, until next week. See ya.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.